blackness. Everybody wants to attack my blackness. Everybody wants to subtract my blackness. Everybody wants to attack my blackness. Blackness, 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 blackness. Everybody wants to attack my blackness. Everybody wants to subtract my blackness. Everybody wants to attack my blackness. Blackness, blackness, blackness.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? Welcome to The Other Experience with your host, Just JB. Today, we have an awesome guest. His name is David Rivers II. And David and I met through my wife and her friend, his wife, Jennifer. And we are fellow sports fans, and he's helping me with finance. And it's been really cool. And when I mentioned this podcast, David was very excited to share his story and come on. So, David, welcome, and thank you for joining. And, you know, tell us a little bit about yourself before we get further into the nitty-gritty here.
Well, JB, I really appreciate the opportunity. Thank you for having me. So, yeah, my name is David Rivers II. I live actually in southern New Jersey, but I was born and raised in Philadelphia. And I have been here in southern New Jersey almost 2 years. My wife and I have two small girls, a 3.5-year-old and a almost 2-year-old daughter. We've been down here in southern New Jersey, like I said, about 2 years. But I was born and raised in Philadelphia. I went to private school in Philadelphia and then graduated from college in Philadelphia. And then came back, moved to Virginia and then came back. But we'll get into that, and then got my master's degree in Philadelphia. But yeah, no, I'm excited to, you know, share a little bit about myself and my day job. I am a financial advisor with Merrill Lynch. I love doing that. I have been with Merrill all told about 3 years. I've been in my current position about 15 months now, based in downtown Philadelphia. Love being able to do that and get out into the community and help people be able to better their financial lives, being able to help shape and change the trajectory and be able to make sure we were organized and ready to go. But also, one of the things I'm passionate about is also getting this information out. I think I have a unique experience, and I've been able to, in my time in both the industry and this just time in the region, have a unique perspective that I'd like to share and be able to bring my story. So I appreciate this opportunity.
Thank you, man. Thank you so much. So yes, you just mentioned wanting to share your story. The Other Experience, this podcast, for those who have the opportunity of listening to this and have listened to past episodes and have seen content that I've put up on TikTok and, you know, the interweb, social media, it's basically about Black people and brown people navigating life who are non-stereotypical and different experiences in regards to that. So it's kind of like being in between a rock and a hard place. Like, mm-hmm. You're navigating life, you're being yourself, but you're basically going to fall into the stereotypes of your race. But at the same time, in being a Black or brown person, you're obviously going to face the pain points of that in America, especially, and likely just existing in general. So there's those instances too. So I like to say that it's like in a 24-hour period, you know, being told you're not Black enough and that you talk too white, but then later on being followed in the store because you're Black. It's kind of just like a very interesting path, an interesting way of being and everything like that. So David, that was my just to the audience listening, that's my kind of continued explanation of why this podcast is happening. And thank you so much for bringing forth your story. So the first question I want to ask you is, you said you grew up in Philadelphia, and with growing up in Philadelphia, were you primarily around Black people in your neighborhood where you grew up?
Yeah, definitely. So I have an older sister. We grew up in the Winfield section of West Philadelphia. So we were not that far from St. Joe's University. And the one thing I will say, growing up where I grew up, is that my parents made a concerted effort. So my sister and I both went to the Episcopal Academy. My sister was there for 13 years. I was there for 14 years. So my entire career from pre-kindergarten through 12th grade. And I went to Episcopal Academy when it was located in Marion. So right across the street from St. Joe's. It is now relocated all the way out to Newtown Square. But there's one thing my parents, so they wanted us to have the best opportunity. And they felt that sending us both through Episcopal Academy would be that opportunity for us to exceed and to excel. But they also made sure that we understood that we, like you had mentioned, that there was a duality to what we were doing. We were obviously in a very elite private school where the majority of the students did not look like us, were white students. Now, I'm happy to say that there was a good mix. There were definitely Hispanic students and there were Jewish students and Asian students from many different backgrounds. But obviously, like you had mentioned in your kind of introduction, there was the trying to bridge two worlds, coming back from Episcopal back into our neighborhood. Now, the one great thing about the neighborhood where I grew up is it was very diverse. Now, it was the vast majority of the families were Black, but it was diverse. And because my parents really pressed hard to make sure that we had an experience and we understood that we were getting this education, but we came from a Black community. My parents both are CU grads. They met at Cheney University. They know that lived experience. My parents are both participants and were literally at the March on Washington when Martin Luther King Jr. gave his famous speech. So they made sure my sister and I understood what our experience was going to be and what it was like, that we were going to have a different experience. And like you talked about, and I always say that Black people are not a monolith and we all have a different experience. That's why I wanted to be a part of this. But, you know, they made sure there was definitely challenges at time. Because like you mentioned, there were times I'm like, you talk white. And then there's like, you are Black. There were definitely experiences when I was at Episcopal when I knew that I was Black. And now fast forward 30 plus years later, I like to say that I'm unapologetically Black. It's just that I may have a different experience from others.
Great. So let's dive in a little bit further into what you just mentioned. You said that when you were at your space of education, you knew damn well you were Black. Can you go a little further into that?
Sure.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So when I was, I believe, the third Black male to go all the way through, we call them lifers, to go all the way through Episcopal Academy. So that should say something. I graduated in 1995 from Episcopal. So it was, I probably in high school started to really realize what my Blackness was. I was, like I said, there was a very small number. I graduated, there were 6 Black students when I graduated from Episcopal out of a class of 99. Now, the one thing, like I said, that helped my experience is I want to say about 10 of us were lifers. So there were 10 of us who had gone through and been together for 14 years. So you really get to know somebody and you're going to be spending all that time with them. My girlfriend at the time, Tamara Dan, who I still keep in contact with, she was also a lifer like myself. Another good friend of mine, his name was Myron Wescott. Both of these are Black students who were there with me. But each of us had different experiences. Even though what was crazy is that the three of us grew up about 4 blocks apart where we were in Winfield. So in that section of where we were in the city, it was definitely Black parents were making a choice. If I stayed in the public school system and had gone locally, I was going to end up probably in Overbrook High School, because where I was seated in Winfield, you would end up in Overbrook. There are some other schools now, but that was not where we were in the early 90s. Now, knowing my parents, and the one thing I was appreciative is that my parents gave both my sister and I a choice in 8th grade. They understood. Like, this could be a lot. There could be a trauma involved with being one of the very few Black students. And definitely, I did not have a lot of Black teachers when I was at Episcopal. My memory is not what I'd like it to be, But I only remember one in elementary school. I do not remember any black teachers in high school.
Okay.
I haven't any in during my high school, my entire, from 9th through 12th grade, I don't remember any black teachers. It is different now. The school has definitely worked on its diversity. But, you know, my parents gave us a choice in 8th grade. Like, do you want to go somewhere else? For me, the choice would have been Central or going to ENS, so Central Engineering and Science. And maybe Masterman, but Masterman is a different animal. But I decided I wanted to say. Same thing with my sister. She'd come out, she would have had the choice to go to Central or go to Girls High. Or she was more artistic than I was. See, you know, Kappa was also consideration for her. But we both decided we wanted to stay. We liked our experience. There was obviously challenges every day that came with doing that. But we liked the experience. I don't think my sister and I were so forward thinking like some students may be now to be like, this is the best thing. It's going to get me into the best college. It's going to set my career. It was more for me, even from my perspective, I enjoyed my time at Episcopal.
Great. So with that said, being so focused with education and forwarding your mind and everything like that, I think that's amazing. And that's so awesome that there was that focus and that drive just to, you know, navigate that, just navigate what you needed to navigate in order to get what you needed to get to. Bottom line, that's incredible. But with that, as you've hinted at, I'm sure there was pain points and obstacles emotionally, mentally that you and your sister faced with that. Can you go into a little bit of what you maybe have experienced in high school and in regards to that?
Sure.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it definitely makes sense. So it was an interesting transition going from, like I said, a lot of us were there together. And in eighth grade, you feel like, especially at Episcopal at that point in time, you feel like you're the greatest. Because the way this said, like everything was situated in terms of Episcopal's campus, there was definitely what we called the upper school, which was 9th through 12th grade, but they were like their own separate building, basically. And then elementary and middle school were all situated in a different building. So by 8th grade, you felt like you're a man. So, and like I said, a lot of us had been together. We didn't, and then the way my class was structured, we didn't get a lot of new students in high school. And a lot of us had been together for a long time. So you really, yes, you're going through the throes of puberty and girlfriends and all the things.
Yeah.
But we had like been together as a group for a little while at this point. Yeah. At the very least, like at least 3 years. I think the newest student came in like 6th grade. But definitely when I got to high school, because I also played football when I was at Episcopal. And I was fast. But I'm not tall at all. And this is not like it is 20 years later where somebody who's 5'6" and at that point in time probably weighed 145 pounds in high school was going to consider playing college ball or anything else. I kind of, well, not stumbled, but I didn't focus until the very end on track. But I, I was just there living my experience at Episcopal. But I'll never forget my football team was never great. We were okay my freshman year, but I was playing freshman football. So I couldn't even dress for the varsity team. My sophomore year, we were pretty good. So our huge rival is called the Haverford School. It's one of the oldest rivalries in private school in the United States. And, you know, the one thing who we always knew was no matter what happened in the season, you dare to beat Haverford. Nothing else matters. Just beat Haverford. But we did really well that season. I was able to dress. But I'll never forget going to a game, getting dressed to go to a game for a varsity team and being stopped by. So my pistol at that point in time sat in Lower Marion. Well, it was in Marion technically, but it was all part of Lower Marion Township. And going to go to a game and being stopped by Lower Marion Township police officer who said, "What are you doing here?" And I'm like, "Well, I am a member of the team." And he's like, "No, there are no black people on this team." So that made me very aware of no matter that I was going to this elite school, whoever I was, like I was still black. I was still a black boy at that point in time. Now, obviously the world has changed and is much different now for the stress that's put on black men and black boys than it was at that point in time, but that made me very aware. And also, I was in high school during major cultural touch points. Like, I am just turned 48 years old. I distinctly remember three major things that happened in the late 80s and early 90s. As a teenage, as a Black teenage boy. And some of it has come full circle at this point in time. So one was the Central Park Five. I distinctly, those five gentlemen are a little bit older than me, but I distinctly remember that. And that obviously is something that's in the political sphere now because of one of the candidates, Donald Trump. And I distinctly remember that when that ad that went out in the New York Post, you know, calling for their execution. And I always tell people now, here we are 30 plus years later, that was when I, in my mind, and even as I was then just a teenager, was like, yeah, I'm not messing with this dude.
Right.
Like those guys looked like me. Some of them came from similar educational backgrounds. Like we're at elite schools and just got caught up in a bad situation. And like, you're calling for the death of these young boys. Now, here we are almost 40 years later. And we now know that that was not the case. The other thing that really, the thing that became very clear to me was Rodney King. Because that was, I was in high school when Rodney King occurred and everything else. And unlike social media and how everything is instant and you can have a million angles, that was new. That was very new to be able to get, like, you had heard stories, but it wasn't, it wasn't my lived experience. My parents were very good about keeping my sister and I involved in different activities. And we didn't interact with the criminal justice system or even law enforcement like that in our daily lives. That's not something we really dealt with. So seeing that at that point in time made things very clear. And I will admit, and in the midst of all that, unfortunately, my parents were separating and going through a divorce. Mm-hmm. So I will admit that made me a very angry young Black boy, a young Black man. Between my sophomore and junior year, I was angry. Just did not really know how to. And my mother was really good about having me sit down, and I had a therapist and was talking with somebody. It was just not having a lot of fun my junior year.
It's a lot going on.
It was definitely a lot going on. And this is, so all of those things made me very aware. That was the first time I became really aware of my Blackness. And I, like I said, I have been able to kind of exist in a bubble. But I will say the one thing that kept me grounded, that made me happy, was football. So we were not great my junior year. We were okay. But I had so much fun on that team. Because that was when I really started to get an opportunity to like really play and make an impact in the game of football. So that kind of balanced everything else. But yeah, I definitely became aware in the early 90s about being Black at an elite private school. And then I had another situation twice where I was called the N-word at Episcopal. It's not like it is now where, you know, you report it and then everything, you know, and there may be social media and things to back it up. I definitely said something about it. And it was, okay, we will confront and deal with this. But yeah, it just made me aware that there was also, it made me aware that influence and power mattered. Because two of the students who said that to me, parents were, one's parent was a very high up athletically at Episcopal. I'm not going to go too deep and name names. And the other one's parents contributed large sums of money to Episcopal.
Of course. So with that said, are you willing to describe the, like, what happened when you were called the N-word? Like, what, like, how were you called the N-word? Like, what was the scenario? What were you doing? You know, what was the...
Sure.
You know, you can remember. If you're willing to go that deep, not a problem.
I don't mind talking about it. I have to realize it was 30 years ago, so I don't remember. I appreciate it.
Paraphrase, high-level summary.
But the first time the guy was, he was like a known athlete at the school and he played football. And I'm trying to think of all the time. Yeah. I probably was a freshman and he probably was either a junior or a senior. and like during practice or something. So we could do like full practices. Like you could practice all together on the team. You may not, you have to be really, really, really elite to make the team as a freshman. And the other thing I talked about now, my blackness, I've really figured out. So my senior year, we had a freshman quarterback. And I came to realize that your name and your influence mattered more than your talent. Because we had a quarterback who had followed, we were all together since our freshman year, and he was going to be the starter. But the other quarterback came from a named family at a festival, and so they inserted him. We did okay, but I was like, okay, this is nonsense. But anyway, back to my story. So yeah, it was like after practice one day, and I admit now that I can have a smart mouth at times. And I like I said, I don't remember all the exact details, but I distinctly remember that he pushed me in, and so I pushed him back, and he just fired off, look here, you N-word, I will beat you up, basically.
Wow.
And I was like, hold on, what did you just say to me?
Yeah.
So then I switch flipped in my head, like, I don't care who you are. And this has been kind of a mantra through all of my life. I don't care who you are, what prestige or money or power you come through. Like, there are certain things that you're not going to be able to say and think you can just get away with. No, there may not be any consequences that happen. I can't control that. At that stage in my life, I couldn't control that. But I need you to know, like, no, this is not acceptable. No, you're not going to sit here and act like you can just nonchalantly throw it out there and there's no consequence. So I said something about it. I don't believe anything happened. Second circumstance, classmate of mine. I'm not particularly proud of this moment. Same thing, probably jawing back and forth, and they threw it out. This time, I was like, you know, enough is enough, and I put my hands on him.
Right.
Because, well, you know what? Sometimes I'll, like, and my wife gets on my case about this at times. I'm like, sometimes, yes, there should be conflict resolution and different things. And I'm like, sometimes sometimes get frustrated that we live in a world where people don't think that you can't get slapped.
Yeah.
I'm saying bring out guns and we do gunplay. Like, we need to get, like, I'm from the, like I said, I grew up and I'm from the 90s. There was, and I lived in Philadelphia in the 90s. So yes, I went through all the stuff with J Black Mafia, all of it. I know what the war was like here in Philly. Even living in Winfield, like, I knew some things. There were certain neighborhoods, obviously, you weren't going in. Obviously, I was starting, you know, to really feel myself. I had a driver's license. Had access to a car. Wanted to be out and about, you know, 16, 17, 18. And had really learned, because that's part of my lived Black experience, too. Like, yeah, you're not from here. So you can't necessarily just move in these circles. But I'm also from an era where you're like, okay, sometimes you just fight. Nobody was going to get shot. Nobody was getting stabbed. You just fight. And I was like, enough is enough. And that moment, I was like, yeah, not today.
Yeah.
And I put my hands on him.
Right.
And that was that.
Well, there's consequences for actions, and that person chose to go in a very ignorant and hateful direction, and he got checked. So,
right.
You know, before I go any further, you know, it's such a shame with our people. I feel like I can go just ask any Black person, when was the first time you were called the N-word? And I feel like I would get a, you know, odds are I'd get a lot of, oh yeah, I remember my first time. Like, I just feel like I would get a lot of answers in regards to that, unfortunately.
Probably, almost certainly, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm sorry that happened to you in your youth, and I hope, yeah, I mean, I don't know, I hope that doesn't happen. I hope it hasn't happened since and won't happen again, but we check and, you know, unfortunately.
It's definitely happened since that point in time.
Oh, of course, yeah.
And I realized that there's different ways to handle things, but B, I've also come to realize over time, like, I don't mind. I'm like, this is the, unfortunately, this sometimes is the world we live in. And people want to take license and think that they can get away with saying stuff. And again, like, you don't think that you can get slapped. And you might, like, you might catch the wrong person on the wrong day and say the wrong thing. And that's that. Like, you just might get, and the him. And that's why I say, not to get very political about this, that for some reason, the former president has got people out here thinking
that they can just pop off at the mouth and there are no consequences. And I'm like, that's not actually how the world works. That's not how the world works.
No.
Like I'd say, I'm like, I am 48 years old and I have a lot of things that I've been able to accomplish in my life and everything else. And there's definitely stuff on the line and things to lose. But there are some things that are non-starters and non-negotiable when it comes to me. And in general, just as being a human on this planet, I try and be every single day a better father and a better husband. But I, you know, and also I am a son and a brother as well. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, trying to be a better human. But everybody has their limits. And there are certain things that you just, you know, it evolves with time that you're not going to put up and deal with.
For sure. Now, David, you were talking about the unfortunate racism, straight up racism you faced at your school. With that happening, can you also describe any, you know, the occurrences where, because of being so studious and being how, you know, how you are, who you are and whatnot, there might have been cases or circumstances where you face pushback or even backlash or denouncement for, you know, how you talk, how you dress,
being
so studious. Feel free to go if you're up for it, more into that.
Yeah, no, definitely. Like, so it was obviously, like I said, we went to Episcopal. We live right by St. Joe's. So going from where we live to Episcopal on a nice day was like a 15 or 20 minute walk. But it was definitely, I always say that you understand once you cross City Avenue that it was different. Well, really, once you got past St. Joe's, it was different. Now, like, I lived in a solidly middle class Black neighborhood where I was in Winfield, and there were other Black families, but my sister and I were very unique. There were not too many other of our peers that were going to private school. Most of them were going to local high schools or the city schools around them. Now, the one thing I am blessed is that, like I said, I grew up in a great neighborhood. And because my parents made a choice, like a very effort to move into where we moved. And my mother was really pregnant with my sister. She was literally a month away. She moved in a month before my sister was born in 1972. And they made that choice to put us in that neighborhood. Could have gone, had the opportunity to be, but they're like, we wanted to be, because it really wasn't about we wanted to be here because it was close to where we're going to send our kids to school. They hadn't thought about it that far in advance. But it was really like, this was a diverse neighborhood socioeconomically, in terms of the different experiences of being Black, of, you know, your lived Black experience. So I'm thankful because in where I grew up in that neighborhood, there was a teasing and different things, but I, you know, the one thing I've always tried to do in my life is be authentically myself. So, you know, I have friends from, we all came from different backgrounds, and it's funny because here you are, you know, 30 or 40 years later, and you're growing adults and families and all these different things. And, you know, you realize as time has passed that some of the things that you thought were important in the arguments and everything else, you realize you got to live authentically who you are. But definitely moving in different circles. I was absolutely confronted with that. Dealt with, who do you think you are? You think you're better than me? But the one thing my parents taught me was, and this definitely came from our faith upbringing as well. The other major thing is that my parents, Lily and my mother, more than anybody else, pushed us at a very early age. We were involved in church. So we grew up in a thing that wasn't known, it's not called the African Episcopal Church of St. Thomas, but it was just the St. Thomas Episcopal Church at that point in time. And it was, and that's the one thing I'm really thankful for my parents, is that they made sure that our experiences came in different settings. When we first joined Episcopal, it was at 52nd and Parish, I think was so that's solidly in West Philly. And the one great thing is that I got introduced to different families from different Black experiences. It was a Black church. Then they relocated to Overbrook. So right at Overbrook and Lancaster Avenue. That was probably in the early 90s. And now kind of coming full circle, having moved away to Virginia and then come back, Jennifer and I are members of Salem Baptist Church. Now, I always joke that I grew up in an Episcopalian experience, and now I'm at a Baptist church, a Black Baptist church, and all the things that go along with that. But there was definitely the times when I was like, you know, you don't feel accepted. And that was, I will say this. So I was, more of those times came from in more social settings. Because I was joking. Like I was awkward in high school.
Who wasn't?
Right. So, you know, but you think you're the man, but I was like, it was the 90s. Like, I'm so happy that we did not have social media. Like, some of these pictures and stuff of outfits, the different choices, your fashion choices and things you were making in the 90s, you're like, oh, thank God I grew out of that.
Flashback.
This is how we do. I was, and that's the one thing I'm thankful for my sister. Like, I was deep to sell and deep into hip hop. Which people are like, how do you even understand that? I've gotten that most of my life. But I'm like, really? They're like, really? How do you come, you grow up, and you grew up in Winfield. You went to Episcopal Academy. You don't understand what the, I was like, yeah, but I appreciate the music. And because the other thing is that my parents, I played the saxophone from fourth grade until, well, for a very long time, I've fallen off from that. I need to get back on the wagon. But I played the saxophone, so I could appreciate good music. And everything, having musical training. And my sister was a singer. And we both played. I played an instrument at Episcopal and my sister sang in Glee Club. So, but we both, I love that about my sister. She was, made sure I understood all, and my parents too, all genres of Black music. So I have a deep appreciation for soul. But I'm like, I've learned, and I guess now, and thank God for my wife, realize like, you just have a nuanced Black experience. And we come in so many different shapes and sizes.
Exactly.
So I'm like, you know, yeah, there was definitely the times when I was checked, and there was definitely the times as a teenage Black boy that it was frustrating, as you couldn't, you know, some girls would not deal with you. Oh, you don't talk like people. I don't. I mean, I talk to people you're used to. But then you live your life. You know, life comes around, and here I am 30 years later, and I am still amazed at this journey.
Definitely, man. When you said people call you out about your hip-hop knowledge or whatnot, one, I got a flashback of when that happened to me when I was in college, but that's something I'll talk about maybe another episode or something I put online. But the question that rang off in my head that when you said that is, how can your card about hip-hop be called out by whoever called you out on it when consumers of genre in mass quantity haven't experienced the content of what's going on? And
that's a great point.
That doesn't make any sense to me.
No. That was, like I said, I am... So, like, one of the seminal moments for me was The Chronic.
Classic.
Yes. So that came out, like, I'm in high school. Mm-hmm. So everybody bought
it. It came out. It was, oh, my gosh. I just realized you were, oh, that must have been amazing. That was right when I was going crazy. Wow. Whoop.
Yes.
That's cool. Man.
Then I was, like, 92. Mm. I want to say 1992.
Yep.
Chronic came out. So here's the interesting thing. So I'm not quite 16, I think, when it drops. So now it's like, I can't go buy the album myself. Cause this is like indating myself. Like, this is the days we had Sam Goody and like Tower Records. Mm-hmm. So, and then it erupted on the scene and it was huge. So it's like, okay, you had to get your parents' permission. And then, you know, there's still, it's explicit lyrics and all these things. So I begged and begged and begged and begged and begged. Finally, my mother got me, and this is dating myself, a tape. Very quickly after that, then, you know, CDs pop on the scene. And I say the next year, the similar moment, and I didn't really get to appreciate it until later in life, Ready to Die.
Wow.
Coming out. Right. So now, and at the time, my sister was dating, because my sister, let me think about this. Yes. So my sister, her sophomore junior, my sister went to Harvard. At Harvard, and the guy she was dating, actually my nephew's father, was from New York. He's from Queens. So He knows all there is to know about this.
Obviously, and he was always musically inclined.
No, everything there is to know about this. Here is this kettle seeing Biggie and then all these different things going back and forth. So I appreciated that. But like my sister, like way back, like my sister got me into, like I was like, you can say because you don't think my experience is the same, but you're not going to question me on do I know and appreciate music and know about it. Because my sister and I, like, and I appreciated my parents, like we knew Public Enemy.
Legendary.
Like, we knew that. And we, you know, it run DMC. So I was like, ML, like early L, cool, like L Cool J when he first dropped. Like I was listening to hip hop and rap. It's probably not a good reflection on my parents and probably more my sister than anybody else who is 4 years older than me. But like we're listening to that in the late 80s. Like L Cool, like L Cool J, Run DMC, all the Public
Legendary. Golden era.
Yes, exactly. The golden era of hip hop. So I'm like, okay, you might question my credentials a little bit because you don't think my life experience and where I grew up speaks to this, but I can understand some of the issues that just the general issues about lack of access and what and being able to deny opportunities because just because I may quote unquote have grown up with a silver spoon in my mouth, which by the way, I did not. We were solidly middle class. People are like, yeah, I did not grow up. We were not a rich family. We were a solidly middle-class family. My parents, I'm not going to apologize. My parents worked very hard and are very well-educated, as am I. But, like, we were not, no, there were no mansions or different things and, you know, trips to foreign countries all the time. No, that was not our experience. But I was like, but I can appreciate that my parents were very highly educated. They went to Cheney University. Both at my father went to Wharton. My mother got her master's degree at Drexel. My mother actually never finished, but was not that far from getting a doctorate. So they understood the value of education and they worked hard to be able to provide us the opportunities, but they were denied opportunities as well. My father especially. And now the one thing that you know, was a little bittersweet for me is that my father is in the throes of dementia and Alzheimer's. So I can't really ask some of the same questions you're asking me to get. You know, now that I am a father of two girls, to get his perspective on what it was like trying to navigate through this world while raising Black children. But I know from things before that point in time, yeah, there was a lot of frustration on my father's part. He had done all the things. He's like, I did all the pedigree. I went to the right name school and there was still denial because no matter how, where you came from, at the end of the day, they just looked at you like you was Black. You was just a Black man.
The unfortunate path and navigation of being Black in America and Black in general.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I want to help to raise awareness to these specific pathways, experiences, because, you know, there's so many stories and there's just a lot of depth and a lot of layers to all this. So, I have a question. Do you feel like, or was there times where you feel like, whether it's in the past or even today, where you have to outright or even subliminally defend your Blackness based on your upbringing and experience?
Absolutely. While you were speaking, it just popped in my head. So full disclosure, this is my second marriage. And in my first marriage, my ex-wife and I came from very different backgrounds. She is brilliant. She grew up in North Philly in a poor neighborhood. But she did really well, went to girls high. It's ironic because my ex-wife and my wife know each other. They're about 3 years apart at girls high, I want to say. 3 or 4 years apart. Can't remember. And then she went to Haverford College. And then We met in Harvard College and College Street Arts. Now my, I'm not even going to try and couch it. So there was always the one thing that I also got challenged with early in my life was the choice of women I wanted to date. People were like, oh, you have a color complex. Everything because I will admit, like looking back and like I said, my brain is not as great as it used to be. But like all the girls, I guess I can remember wanting to date or going out and dating were definitely light skinned. Absolutely. Then fast forward, I meet my ex-wife. We actually met through a high school program I was in at Ed Temple, a high school. It's called Minority Access to Research Careers. In a prior life, I thought I was going to be a neurosurgeon, but I realized that my calling fell into financial services. But she was light-skinned. We came from different backgrounds, and that was definitely something that I had to deal with. Absolutely something I had to deal with. And even in somewhat from her, because it was like she came from a different background, but and she looked at me and where I came from, and I was like, our life is our life. And then we had really hit home because she then graduated. I graduated from Temple in December. I finished in December 2001. I graduated in February 2002. And then my ex-wife had graduated from Haverford College in May of 2001. So she had gotten into medical school, which was a dream of hers at the University of Virginia. And she moved to Charlottesville, where UVA is, in July of 2001. And I followed her down there in February 2002. So that shaped me to who the man I am now, because I lived down south.
Okay.
And it did not, and I very quickly learned it didn't matter what shade you were and what your pedigree was, you were always just a Black person down there. Now, Charlottesville, crazy enough, makes the news. I had moved out of there by then. But my ex-wife and I definitely, some of the issues we may have felt that I dealt with in our lived experience, and people were like, you don't measure up, or you think you're better, or this and that. We had to kind of confront that on our own. And unfortunately, because of our upbringing, it drove a wedge. It really did. It drove a wedge in our marriage and everything else. We just came from different backgrounds. And so we ended up, obviously, divorced when I moved back home in 2012. But that really impacted on me. People were like, you only date a certain woman. I came back and I was a single man. So, 2012, 2013, I also found an opportunity to be in financial services filing. And I was like, I was 36 years old. And I was like, I'm gonna live my best life and have a great old time. God had a different plan, because I met Jennifer the first time in April of 2013. And we started in, it's funny enough, we're coming up on it. We started about, went out on our first date, October 26th of 2013, and we have been together ever since. So God had a different plan. My wife is brown. We're same kind of complexion. I always say that because she's like, I don't have a color thing. And she said, sometimes this is the road that I've been led down and people talk about. This and that, and you make certain choices. And I've come to realize at this point in my life, at 48 years old, that I'm just going to try to be the best version of myself and be the best father I can be. It's funny because my two girls are different shades. One's a little bit brighter than the other. But, and that is what I look at now. Like, what am I doing to prepare my daughters for this world that is going to see them? And it's hard. It has absolutely been very challenging at times in my life being a Black man. But now, being married to my superstar of a wife who is, God willing, finishing her doctorate in the next few weeks, and being a father of two Black daughters, it's like, what am I doing now to make sure that when Black women who are, and we can see just from what we're dealing with politically, who really are at the bottom. And I'm like, I am a father of two Black daughters, but I understand that. I think for you, and not to turn it back on you, I know what's going on in your life, what this is like raising a biracial child.
Yeah, man. Yeah, definitely. It's funny you mention that, because there are times in conversation with my wife and I, my mind has shifted where I really strategically think about my kid, my son, and I'm like, honestly, there have been times where I'm like, it's not even about how I feel about this certain scenario. I need this to happen so he can have a positive experience,
right,
and whatnot. So there's that definitely, you know, everything said in regards to that definitely plays a part in it, especially with him being biracial. I made no qualms about this. It is, I actually have met, unfortunately, I've met self-haters before who are biracial for whatever reason. And it just really stuck out in my mind, like how that could even happen. And it's a big point for me and goal for me to make sure that he completely understands that there's equal support on both sides and that he is loved on at all aspects. And you know, just I can just go on forever with that. So, but that in saying that, that is gonna, you know, I'm gonna have to prepare him for, you know, the things that we as Black men and Black people in general go through in there. I'm sure you've had, you know, you thought about that endlessly with your daughters and everything like that.
Clearly, yeah,
it's gonna suck. I actually talked about this not too long ago. I'm like, man, it's gonna really suck to have. I hope there's a day where Black fathers and Black mothers, or mothers in general, of, you know, children of color, don't have to have, particularly Black from the Black spectrum, where they don't have to have that conversation of, yeah, you're going to be called the N-word. It's going to happen to you. And, yeah, being, you know, sad.
Yeah, my wife and Jennifer and I talk about that. Like, they're going to become, and especially having daughters, not even that, there's going to be the N-word. They may be crossing the B-word. And like,
and
it's different for me being a father of daughters. Like, there's some things that I've told them. They obviously, like I said, they're 3.5 and 2, almost 2. Like, they're not going to absorb all this, but I'm like, it's important for me to say it out loud. Like, this is probably something I should say too much out loud, but I'm like, yeah, he can't put his hands on you.
Right.
Like, ever. Like, if he puts his hands on you, that's a death sentence. I told him, and they're not getting that. They're 3.5 and 2, but like, there's some things for negotiables. Like, there are certain, like, that, and like, they can't, like, you don't have to, and it's different because I obviously don't, that's not my lived perspective. Like, I'm so thankful for my wife who will be able to guide them on that journey, but as their father, there are some things I need them to understand. And that's why it's really important for me to model certain behaviors so that my daughters understand, and my wife is really good about this. And I'm so thankful for my father and my father-in-law, because each of them in their own way have helped influence me about what it's like to raise Black daughters. And my sister and my wife are amazing. But, you know, I'm having the conversations. Like I said, my father has dementia, so I can only get it in snippets at times. But definitely I have very deep, and I'm thankful that I had wonderful conversations with my father-in-law, John Carroll, about what it's like to raise a Black daughter. Because I think it was different, obviously, because it was the 80s. And I'm doing this in 2024 and later in life. You know, being a father of toddlers in your late 40s is different. It's definitely different. It's different. I say that, you know, he always shares with me, he was like, my number one goal for my daughter was to make sure, and you see it, obviously, she's your wife, that she can do whatever she wants. She can have any opportunity she wants, but also to realize that she's going to run into struggles throughout this life. But I also look at it like now, at being a solidly middle-aged man, I look at it like this is the life that God intended for me. It is my responsibility to keep on moving forward and doing, you know, trying. I always say that my job, my responsibility now is to be the, put my family, you and I talked about this, like, put my family in the best position to win. So what am I doing and challenging myself? That's the thing, my new mantra. What am I doing to challenge myself? Because it's very, you're going to understand this, it's very easy to get settled into a routine.
Totally.
But I'm like, what am I doing to demonstrate, especially with children now, to demonstrate about forward momentum and what are you doing? And not, because the other thing that sometimes does frustrate me, and it took me a while to notice myself, was you can get caught up in all the different aspects, and you and I are having this conversation about Blackness and our different lived experiences. In blaming that, like, and not having any momentum and blaming that for your lot in life. But everybody, I firmly believe that God gives everybody a talent, and everybody's going to have their own journey and their own struggle. So I look at it like, okay, yeah, these things happened to me. Some of them were negative and painful, but I'm still here. So what am I doing to just keep on pushing forward every single day? Like, nobody's perfect. There are days when it's a struggle and there are days when it's great. But what am I doing to keep on pushing forward every single day and demonstrating to my children and to my family and ultimately out into the world about, you know, you take, these are your experiences. They shape you into who you are. I am a God-fearing man first. I am absolutely, but the first thing you're going to see about me is that I am the Black man, but there's more nuance in it. I am a father and a husband and a son and a brother and an uncle and, you know, a friend and, you know, God willing, being able to help to shape and lead and be a leader. So, you know, those aren't the only things that I am. Those are just parts of who I am every day. And I know some people get very caught up in one thing or the other. And I think over my lived experience, I've learned to remain fairly even and then realize that not to get too high, not to get too low, but you have to have forward momentum.
Everything you said, man, that was amazing, which leads me to this question. Based on everything you were saying, it sounds like you have been able to take your nuanced Black experience and turn it into a strength. When did you realize you could do that?
That's a good question. And probably 2016. I had been struggling to be successful in being in financial services. I started off at Prudential, did that for almost 2 years. No, a little bit over 2 years. And then I was at Mass Mutual, but I wanted to be on the investment management side. You and I had talked about this. I just didn't know how to get there. I really, more than anything else, my father taught me this, I did not acquire my fear. So after my time at Mass Mutual, and then a lot of what I was doing was commission-based, and I was broke. My best friend and I were like, he and I are both doing well now, but like, that's why I'm so thankful for him. It was 10 plus years now, but we were like, we don't even know how we made it back then. I was broke, JB. Like broke. But I was getting sick of that. And I was like, I can't keep on doing this. Like I met a wonderful woman, my wife now, and she was really patient. Jennifer is amazing and awesome. And I always like my running joke, I'm very self-aware of who I am at this point in time. At 40 years, I'm very self-aware. I was like, look, I get it. I can understand the picture. People are like, what? Like, you have all this. But then, you know, when I start, on the surface, you see me, and you'll see the students, you and I, you understand how I dress as a financial advisor. And had my wonderful, nice luxury car and everything else. But my wife, I will admit, and I love her for this, keeps me very humble. Like, her running joke with me now that I'm living life in reverse, because I like have the car and everything else, and I'm living like a single man who's 20. Who have paid food children because I just run anything about not wanting food and all the stuff in my car. She's like, you have two kids, suck it up. That ship sailed. You should have done something different before while you were single and you came home, but I didn't. But I say all that to say that, you know, I sit here and I'm just like, all right, well, what can I do? I need to make my, I'm with somebody who I think I can have a future with, but I need to have steady income. So I had applied for a job at Citizens Bank, got it. And it put me in, it was like a fish out of water in the beginning. I was in a completely different circumstance. Obviously, I talked a little bit about my upbringing and who I was. So from an academic perspective, I graduated from Temple with a marketing degree in 2002. And then in 2012, I finished my master's degree in international business management completely online through the University of Phoenix. So I got all these degrees and all this training and everything else, all this schooling, I like to say. But I was like, what am I doing to make it? That was the thing that got kept. What am I doing to make an impact? Because Jennifer always challenged me, like, what are you doing? It's nice you can have all the money in the world, but what are you doing to really make the money? I know just in your core, you want to get all this information that you have about financial services. You want to get it out to the world. So like people in disadvantaged communities. Black communities, brown communities, Latino communities, immigrant communities, LGBT communities, communities that traditionally don't get this information, because she's like, you firmly believe, and it is the truth. I firmly believe that, hey, the cliche saying is money is power, but I believe that, I always say that, what are we doing to build? Because wealth is financial freedom, and financial freedom allows you to make different choices. So I always look at it like, okay, what am I doing to make that impact? So when I got the job, I ended up at a branch at 5th and Godfrey, right there in the Only section. That's not a place I had hung up. I did not grow up around there. So I was, and then here I come, with all the schooling, the way I talk, it was a fish out of water. And like, they're like, and it was definitely different for the clientele that came in there. But the thing that, more than anything else that helped was, I was authentically myself. I was like, yeah, no, there's going to be the suits and all this, and there's going to definitely be a little bit of cockiness involved in this and everything else. But then once people got to know me, I was like, at the end of the day, I firmly believe in my heart, I'm trying to help the world become a better place and help you to get reach whatever goal you are. And I had a really good friend of mine who became a mentor, and like a big brother who became the manager there, who pushed me hard to get out of my own way at times. And he would definitely put me down at times to keep me in check. But he was like, you can be, I'll never forget, he came to me and he was like, you'll be good. My role was a licensed banker, but he was like, but you just have a natural gift for leadership. Like once people get through and they understand who you are, they have to get through some things with you, but they understand that you are very loyal. As long as you prove yourself to them and they prove themselves to you, you will follow them. You will go through a wall for them, which is the truth. So I realized then, and that's probably the first kernel that I had about being in a leadership position. But like I say, this is about quieting your fear. So I was like, I really wanted to see what I could do. And then I was blessed enough to get my first securities license at Citizens. And I was like, oh, okay. So this is what this is about. And this is what this can really do. Fast forward 2.5 years later, I'm able to join Mel the first time. And I finally passed my exams and get through everything else. But then I passed my final securities exam on March 5th of 2020. And we know what happened. 2 weeks later.
Yeah.
And now we're in COVID.
Yeah. World shut down.
It's different. And the world shut down. But I'm very thankful that I went through that experience. And that really kind of schooled me on the power of what I can do and being able to change people's lives. But like you and I had talked about recently, I've now come to realize at this stage in my life that one of my other best friends was like, he's challenging me about what am I doing for, because I had to realize like I'm middle-aged, ageism is a thing. So he's like, what are you doing to challenge yourself for the remainder of your career? Because I'm like, damn, it's 48. I really do remember meeting Jennifer, and I was like, I'm in my mid-30s, living my best life. Or so I thought, not realizing I'm the best version of my life now, being a suburban dad of two girls. That's my running joke. But I'm like, you know, now it's like, I want to get into a position in a role to be able to shape the next generation. This is it. I'm frank and I'm honest with myself. I love what I do every day, but this is a young man and young woman's game. Definitely. Like I have coworkers that I am old enough to be their father.
Okay.
So I'm like, what am I doing? And I know that that may suppress the amount of money that I could make. But I realize like, I always tell people, as long as my family is straight, we are comfortable, I don't need the whole world. Just a little piece of it. I just want to be able to make my impact. And I was like, you know, if I can get into a role, in a position where I'm able to help to lead team or help advisors understand what this game is, because it's hard. It's tough. It's challenging. And I'm really appreciative for my market leader where I am at Narrow. His name is Jamil Addison. He is amazing and great. And it's interesting because this is another Black man who reminds me of my manager back in Citizens. And the same thing. He's challenging me. He was like, I mean, you're doing okay as an advisor, but your talents really lead to being able to, you're a great listener and understand the nuances of people. It actually helps you with your client base, but more than anything else, it helps you to understand these new, because I say that in my industry, now that the trend is you bring a lot of young people in there and they're coming through with these, they're amazing. They come through with all the knowledge and intellect in the world. They're graduating with finance and economics degrees and coming out, but they don't understand because they are coming right out of college, like lived experience, like living in the world and what that takes and what that entails. Because I look at it like we are well compensated between $80,000 and $90,000. Let me tell you something, JB. If I had graduated from college and was getting a job that was paying me $80,000, I would have lost my mind.
I understand.
I would have lost my mind. But it's all right, but I understand now that, you know, what responsibilities are and the different things that go into that. And so I look at it like, you know, what am I challenging? Like I said, what am I challenging myself to do every single day, forward momentum to keep on pushing forward and being able to, you know, share my, that's why I'm so thankful for you allowing me to do this, to share my lived experience. Because everybody has a different story.
Exactly, man. And you mentioned earlier that you try to be authentic in every facet. I think that's amazing because that, I guarantee you, you know, I know how challenging that can be, but I firmly believe that's the right and natural path to be, because who else would you be than yourself and be authentically who you are? So in doing that, though, there's going to be times where people aren't ready for that. People don't know really how to handle that. People are going to have their own type of prejudices. People are going to have their own type of, you know, stereotypes, their type of thoughts, their type of thoughts and whatnot. And, you know, with that said, in doing that, can you provide, are there any examples you can provide of having you as a Black man, as a Black person in general, question because of, you know, the way you talk, or you mentioned earlier how you dress for meetings or whatnot. You have any examples that you mentioned that you're willing to share?
Yeah, definitely. So there's two things that pop into my mind. So obviously I have gray hair, I put my head down and everything else. So I've run into this multiple times. Normally we're a unit. Like I'm out there in a unit, but I've absolutely been out with my daughters. And it's more funny, and I'm like, okay, I get it. But sometimes it can tend to bother me because I get like, oh, you're out here with your grandkids. I'm like, no, these are my daughters. These are my children. And then it's the look, people start to get people, yeah, they're like, because you hear about it and you read about it on social media, but like the vast majority of people do not actually know somebody who has kids in their 40s. Like the vast majority, until I pop on the scene. But I tell people, I was like, okay, judge yourself, first off. Don't judge me. My daughter, you're fine. And I tell people, I was like, I had my children when I was supposed to. This is a real talk. I was not ready to be, I was entirely too selfish. I was not ready to be a father when I met Jennifer the first time in 2013. I wasn't even ready to be a father with Jennifer when I got my great paying, well-paying job at Citizens in 2016. My kids happened when they were supposed to happen. Did I think in my mind, in my plan that I had in my head, and as the saying goes, God laughs at your plans, that I think I would become a father for the first time at 44? Hell no. No, I thought I'd be done having kids at 44. I didn't even think I'd have kids that late in life. And that wasn't what the plan was from God. The other thing is, and I love my employer, I love Merrill, but so this is my second stint. I was there the first time from November 2019 till November 2021. And I did a lot of my training in downtown Philadelphia. You've been there to our office at Four Pin Center. So I'll never forget. It's like probably So it was before the pandemic, but it probably was early 2020, January, February. And I'm waiting on the elevator. I think I was going downstairs. There's a Dunkin' Donuts right below our building. I think I was just going downstairs. So I was waiting in the lobby for an elevator, and a white woman walks out. I'm dressed in a suit and everything else. And she was like, "Can I help you? Why are you here?" And I'm like, "No." Now, my wife has helped me, has been great, because she worked in the education space about the concept of microaggressions and, you know, challenging you if you're in a space that people don't think you belong. And that's all I said. I was like, I could have gone full angry black dude and be like, why would you even answer that question? Blah, blah, you know, make a whole thing. Or I'd be like, and I've learned this in life, like, why are you giving energy to that? And I was like, no, I don't. And that caught her completely off guard. So she expected me to be like, why, and probably to go one way, which is, why would you even answer that question? I belong here. Or be like, yes, I need that. I'm looking for X, Y, and Z. And I was like, no, I'm fine. I'm going downstairs. And that was it. And she just sat there for a second, looked around, obviously confused the hell out of her. And she walked back into her door. And I was like, I belong here. You may not think I belong here, but guess what? You don't sign my checks. So I don't have to actually have, that's the other mantra. I was like, ultimately, I always joke like, I really, at the end of the day, I only have to answer to God. But I really, you know, in a real perspective, in the world, real world, well, that is part of the world, but the other part, I was like, I've got three women I got to answer to. Outside of that, the rest of y'all, and, you know, there's still my family and other people, but at the end of the day, the rest of y'all are just, you know, it feels like, it really goes through my, do I really feel like dealing with you? I have to answer to my wife. I have to answer to my daughters. The rest of y'all know I don't. So I'm like, in both of those circumstances, I was like, you, okay, you may have your opinion on things and when, you know, how I've been exposed and, you know, do I belong in this situation and everything else, but I don't have the answer to you. That's what I'm telling you. I'm not going that way to disrespectful, but I will say that over my time, because I run into this situation as well. Like, I'm not going to be disrespectful, but you put your pants on. Like, don't, I need you to understand that your title and where, whoever you are in life does not automatically mean that I have to do X, Y, and Z. And I've worked in the corporate space for a long time. So some people, their title goes to their head. I've had experience, especially where I am at Merrill, because we are obviously part of the larger Bank of America ecosystem. And when I first started here, I was in a branch. And I've had experiences where people higher up in leadership have come in there and they're like, and it's happened back to me because I make friendships and I make relations because I'm authentically myself. It has helped me to avoid certain issues, and sometimes it hasn't. But I've just gotten back to it. They're like, you just seem, they're like, yo, and in some of my previous stops in corporate world that have cost me some opportunities, or I've had to get out of the certain opportunities, was because they're like, oh, like he doesn't necessarily play the game, or he comes across as arrogant. And I'm like, it's not that I'm arrogant, because I don't believe that I am. It's just that I'm being authentically myself. And I will readily admit, like, if I don't feel like doing this, I'm not going to do it. And I don't have, that's the difference. I've played this corporate game a long time. I have been doing this, steadily working for like corporations and financial services. If I go way back to my time in Charlottesville, 15 years. Like, I've been doing this a fairly long time now at this point in my life. And I'm like, I don't have to, like, no, I'm going to be me. I understand that I'm thankful for the employment that I have. I understand the rules. I am definitely somebody who understands handbooks and rules and all the different things that go into it. But I'm going to be me. And if you get to know me, you will understand that as long as we build a level of trust and respect, then we'll be fine. I will be like, yeah, I will go through a wall for you. As long as there's a level of trust and respect, but I'm not, and I understand, I respect the title that you have, but I've learned in my life that a lot of people are caught up in titles and like their titles define them. And that's the thing. What I'm doing, what I do professionally isn't the only thing that defines me. it helps pay the bills, which is important to support my family. Do not get me wrong. But it doesn't define me. It's not the only thing that's happening in my life. It doesn't define me. And I know a lot of people, it defines them. But I am so thankful that where I am currently, my market leader, he's the one who presses that. Especially for me, he was like, don't let this define you. So he's helping me to figure out what the, you know, what the next stage, what the next step looks like.
So thanks for that answer. Just gonna change gears a little bit here.
Mm-hmm.
When you were growing up in Philadelphia, with your experience, I'm wondering, did you meet other Black people from the hood who maybe, trying to say this in a layered way, were there any instances where other Black peers of yours that grew up in the hood and had a different experience than you grew up with shortchanged themselves?
Absolutely. So my parents went to Cheney, and two of my godmothers, obviously, are very close. They all went to Cheney together. One of them has a son who's brilliant. Was it like a gifted, a pride. Like he did things with a basketball that I didn't make sense to me. His father died young, who was also my godfather. Died young. He sure. died when he was at a for a very formative age. So we were preteens, like 12, 11 or 12 when that happened. And he had all the time in the world. He went to Central and everything else, did a little bit of college, but he was about that life. Liked fast money. Liked, he could always, you know, it was the one thing that always, and he and I were both short and everything mm-hmm. else in here, but he could always get girls. Cause he just had, he had a level of confidence and swagger that I did not have. And he definitely could have gone to any elite private school, but my godmother taught at Central. So he went to Central. Great on the basketball court, did all the things, but he liked fast money and women. So, you know, it's fast forward 30 years later, we run into each other occasionally and everything else, and he's doing well for himself now. But, you know, I know he, when we get in the real conversations, he's like, this is not what I thought it was going to be. I was like, yeah, no, I get that. And then I look at the other example that pops in my head is, he's doing really well for himself too, is my barber, who I know we grew up together. And he has absolutely turned his life around. But like in the beginning, yeah, same thing. He was going down a dangerous path and found God.
Okay.
And that changed everything for him. And he realized, I can't keep on going down this path. It could cost me my life. So mm-hmm. I always say to I firmly believe that God instills a tower or whatever God you, whatever faith and whatever God you believe in. And I am obviously come from a Christian faith, but whether you be Muslim or Jewish or whatever background you come from, I believe that whatever higher power instills in you a talent to be successful and to be, make an impact on the world. But it is absolutely your responsibility to take advantage of that. Or if you don't, you get to the point in your life when you have to take stock of that. And you have to be like, okay, why am I not where I'm supposed to be? And that's what I think our challenge as Black men and as fathers, it's very easy for us to blame the system. The system is the reason I'm not getting there. You need to take a hard look in the mirror. And be like, why am I really, I know people older than me and younger than me who had all the same opportunities in life. A painful story for me, but my real best friend, God rest his soul, all the town in the world, parents made different choices and nothing against them, but had made different choices to send all three, him and his two sisters, they came to the public school system. We graduated from King, but he was just on a different, I love him to death. He was a creative type, but he was just on a different path. But Black parents in the 90s weren't letting their kids, their Black children, just be aimless. Like they spend time, whether it be, we spend time and money sending you to private school or whatever else we did, you were going to college. Now, I will say this, me and my best friend who died absolutely should have taken a gap year. Both of us, because I went to Carnegie Mellon, which is where I started school, and did horrifically. Got a lot of debt and came out with sub 2.0 GPA. So I should not have gone, but that's not what was supposed to happen. When I say that, I'll just say, I was like, he and I, but we bonded because we were a little bit eclectic and we came from different backgrounds, but we met at St. Thomas, met at church, and it was, almost over 40 years ago at the 20. But the thing that frustrated me, and he knew that, more than anything about him was he had all this talent, but he never took advantage of it. And then he had a physical injury occur to him. He was also born with a blood disorder. He had sickle cell anemia. And that didn't allow him to be as athletic as he wanted to be and do all the things. Then a freak accident happens. And that was really the beginning of the end. It took 10 years. But I know now, and I miss him every day, I know now at this stage in my life that it really changed his trajectory. It changed his thinking of who he was and how he was going. And he has a son and how, the type of father and the man he was going to be married. And I try my hardest not to live my life with regrets. But one of the things that I definitely wish I could take back is that he got, I'm trying to be raw and honest, and his family won't like me saying this, but eventually he got addicted to pain pills. Nobody wants to talk about it, but that's what happened. And that was definitely the beginning. That was definitely a wall in his way. And he, under the influence of pain pills, he said something to a family. One of the family, granted, it's his own family, but said something to a family. They're like family to me. And I was like, I read him the Riot Act. I was like, I don't care what's going on in your life. I understand the stress. Of course I know. We talk about it. And I understand you're stressed out and you're just really frustrated over a situation or anything else. But he said something to his mother, which was unforgivable in my mind. And I read him the Riot Act. That was the closest we ever came to blows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I had to walk away. But the thing that hurts more than anything else is that our whole relationship changed at that point in time. And we never reconciled. And June 29th, 2019, I get a phone call from his sister. Like, you gotta come to the hospital. He's had a bad medical diagnosis. I get there, he's already gone.
Oh, wow. What happened? What did he pass away from?
He had gone, he and his wife had gone out of the country to Jamaica. So he was always susceptible to infections and everything else. So like he had to be aware. I'm convinced that something happened. He got an infection or something down. And it was one of the Caribbean. I almost say just Jamaica. It was one of the Caribbean islands. I can't remember. But he comes back. It might have been Jamaica, Bermuda, or the Bahamas. And so they go to the hospital. And they're like, they can't. He's just tired and fatigued and they can't diagnose it. He gets checked into Chestnut Hill Hospital. And his organs and everything just start to shut down. So then he gets life flighted. He gets life flighted to Jefferson Neurosurgical Hospital in downtown Philly. And then he has a massive brain bleed. And that's it.
Oh my God.
Yeah. I'm thankful because I got a few moments on that. I'll never forget. It was a Saturday. I got a few moments on that Saturday to be in the room with him, but it broke my heart.
That's tough, man.
And I say all to say because I realize the talent that you have is the talent that you have in front of you, but it is up to you to exercise and to take advantage of the talent. Nobody is perfect. We are all human, so we are all infallible. But it's up to you to be able to take advantage, and then. You got to come to a point in your life, especially as Black men, when you have to take stock of who you are and take responsibility for the decisions that you've made.
Exactly. Yeah, for sure. Definitely. That's very unfortunate. I'm sorry what happened to your friend there. That's awful. But he's, you know, he's in a better place. I like to ask this to all my guests. Why do you think that we decide to call each other's blackness out or go there when there's so many different experiences and so many different pathways that one could live? Do you think it's a mix of youth? Do you think it's just a mix of ignorance? What do you think in regards to that?
Well, I will say this, that and that's why I'm so thankful for my wife, because she has exposed me to a lot of different material, whether it be podcasts or documentaries, stuff that wouldn't be in my worldview. And I would say that I'm like, slavery did a number on us. And it's still doing a number on us 405 years after the first slaves landed in Jamestown, Virginia. They have got us, and I could use the collective they. Let's say white supremacy has got us thinking that crabs in the barrel is a good strategy, and that I look at I do this as a financial advisor, and I understand the collective economic power that we possess as black people, but it's very easy if you have been able to introduce different concepts over time to get us to turn on each other. I look at it like we're in this season now politically. We have a choice to make. What's going on? And like Jennifer knows, like I'm at this point where it just drives me crazy. You know, you and I were talking about it before we joined. And you can see from my shirt, an enormous Eagles fan. Right. But it drives me crazy that every 2 seconds after a break, there's some political commercial. And I just hit beep.
Don't be Kamala Harris is next victim.
Right. That. There's the Howling or
beat. Before by Donald Trump.
Oh, right. My gosh. All those come by commercial. And there's obviously the presidential ones, but even like being where I am in South Jersey, which is like, I don't get, like, there's not a lot. Well, there's a few things about South Jersey, but a lot of them are about the Pennsylvania race. Because, you know, I learned this. My wife is a political science major. I definitely believe that all politics are local, but all politics are also about the money. Yep. And they've got, and that's the one thing that does frustrate me. I will admit, have I ever had huge, enormous sums of money in my life? No. So I don't know what it's like. If I was a millionaire, would I make different choices? But I hope, but I pray in my heart that because of my faith in God and what I've learned and the lessons that have been imparted into me from so many different people in my life, that I'm not going to let money dictate every decision I've made in my life. Like, we're in this season, like, we obviously have a choice of electing a black woman to become president of the sitting chair in the highest seat in the land, to become president of the United States. And I've had this conversation with multiple black men about, and I know some people were up in arms about President Obama calling out, but it's like, yeah, that's real. And I've had this conversation sitting in my barbershop, getting my hair cut. Like, yeah, I understand, but like, I need you to have a good, sound explanation of why you're not doing this. Because at the end of the day, that means your sexism and your chauvinism is coming through. And there's one thing I always say for myself, like my guy said, my daughters are young now, but I'm raising kids in the internet age. Stuff is there forever. So I look at it now, like there's stuff that I'm like, thank God it wasn't the internet. In 2009 and 2010 and those times, because then I got some explaining to do.
Yeah.
Like, but I'm like, you know, stuff that I put out into the world now, it may seem like a long time, but, you know, 15 years from now, I might have to sit down and have an honest conversation. And I use, like, one of the examples I use, and it's funny, but a lot of younger coworkers, so they always ask, I will readily admit I have strong opinions on certain things. But, like, one of the conversations we keep on getting into, and I'm like, I give him my opinion, I don't understand if you think it's going to change. It's about Diddy. And I was like, but here's the thing, because I'm a man of a certain age. I was like, I know Diddy from, like I said, 93. And I had one of my family members who lived in New York City for a very long time and was dropping stories about him in the late 90s. So he's right. Always been that guy. And I was like, what he did is flat out unforgivable. I don't even talk. I'm not even talking about, I mean, even if, like, there's always the stories that are out there, the sex parties, all that stuff. I'm like, just the footage that we saw of what he did to Kat, which, by the way, I don't even wanted to see. Like, my wife might, you know, get in these stories. I'm like, I don't, why do I want to bring that into my life, into my worldview? But sure enough, I'm watching probably CNN one day and it comes across and finally had to see it. And I was like, this is what I tell people. I'm like, you might not like it and it might not seem the nicest thing in the world. But I was like, but here's the thing. Cassie has a father, sons, a brother, and a husband. There is a bullet in this world with Sean Combs' name on it. And I understand I'm on a podcast and this could get out into the ether and I might deal with the blowback from it. But there are some things that you, I don't care. Where you're like, flat out, I don't care what's going on in your life and everything else, a lot of different things. There's some things you flat out don't do. And that sometimes, and I bring up that point and everything else, that sometimes the things that I, the discussions I get in with other Black men, I'm like, yeah, it's, and it's like sometimes you and I both living in this region, dealing with the violence that's going on and people running around, running amok. Around all over, you know, these all these fools running around with guns and stuff and carjackings and shooting and hitting runs and everything else. And people want to go, oh, it's because, yes, you're right. There is the opportunity. Yes, there is the legacy of white supremacy and slavery that has still going on, like I said, 405 years later. But what you're doing is you're excusing the fact that these people don't have any, they have, that means they have no moral code. And that right there, we need to be self-reflective on. You got to stop blaming slavery and all that for that. That means what type of parent are you? What type of lessons are you imparting in your home? And I go back to the reason that's why it's very important that my daughters see how I interact with their mother and the man that I am. Am I perfect every day? No. Like I said, I'm a 48-year-old father of two young girls. It is frustrating as hell. And they humble you, you know that from having a one-year-old. Like, they humble you. They make you think you're the greatest. If you're doing something and then they make you feel like I have failed. It's a the guy told you, like, yeah, the first, you know, the first year of your life is just to keep them alive. They're going to be the good days. They're going to be the bad days.
Yeah, exactly.
But I thought, but, you know, answering your question, it's like, it's so easy and so reductive to say, to blame it on this person, that person. You have to, at the end of the day, take a look at yourself and say, what did I do? What have I done? What have I not done to, like I said, to make, you know, be better every day? It's too easy to say, oh, because of my circumstance, because I grew up in North Philly and I grew up in poverty, this is the only option. Because that's, I mean, excuse my language, that's bullshit. Because there, I know too many people who have made it out of North Philadelphia. I have a brilliant coworker who is from that neighborhood. And it's going to go on and do great things. Shout out to Terrain Johnson and TJ. He said, so stop missing me with that. Oh, it's because of my, no, it's not. That's what it is at the end of the day is one of the older human emotions on earth. And that's greed. Exactly. You want what others have or what you see. And then I also, and it's the old man part of me, social media has made got people confused thinking that this stuff is easy and it's so easy and this person can do it. Why can't I? And like the value of hard work, like you need to work for things in life. That's part of living.
Exactly. I agree 100%. With that said, do you have anything else to say in regards to what we've been talking about or discussion this evening and in general?
Yeah, I would say first things first, because I see your shirt, go Eagles. That's right. Do yeah, what we do. Lines and everything else, you're going to see. And see what this looks like. I did not. You and I were talking right before that. I thought the Commanders had lost. I was in a happy place. They obviously turned the game off to get ready for this. And you told me about a Hail Mary. So we got work to do. The Commanders are good. But I would say that I'm very thankful for this opportunity more than anything else. So thank you for this, JB. I'm glad that we are able to connect this way. And
course.
You know, this is just me. This is my little piece. I appreciate you allowing me to tell my story. That's not the entirety of it. But to know that, you know, I just am trying to be out here in this world, bringing goodness to it, making a change, being able to help everybody do better. Not just, but I'm unapologetically Black. And, you know, I want Black people to understand the collective power that we have, but also understand that we are not a monolith. That our stories come in so many different, varying circumstances. Because at the end of the day, you're still human. And your experience is different. My experience is different than yours.
But to know that
we have an opportunity to do great things and to do wealth. You just have to be able to, you got to be willing to work for it. And if you don't work for it or things go the way you don't expect, you need to take stock about why that did not happen.
Couldn't have said it any better, man. And with that said, thank you for joining us. And have a good one. And to everyone listening, have a good evening, have a good night. Thank you for tuning in.
Take care.